Blog Talk Radio.
To this version of Sonic Effects, and it's a pleasure to have you sitting in with us again today. A very forceful, manly kind of a topic. Commentary is revenge over apathy. You can tell what was on my mind when I was writing this. And I start with, to find men who have the capability to benefit from Freemason. Very compelling, but the excitement today comes also from the efforts of the poet Rainier Marie Rilke, the Prague-born writer. Actually, a fascinating find, a discovery for me. And that I felt compelled to share with you. Fascinating because of the influences, and not only that, but what he was able to do with those influences as a writer. And I'm going to share one of his short poems today. It's called The Walk. I think you'll enjoy the writing. Usually I try to address questions in the program that I think have some bearing or relevance to many thinking people. And today is no different. It's no different at all. I can't help but appreciate how mind-numbing the flow of information can be at times. I don't know if I'm exactly troubled knowing that somebody is trying to influence my thinking to serve their own purposes. It is more an acknowledgement. Somebody is always ever present trying to sell either an idea or a commodity. And so, as you know yourself, as you're becoming more experienced in life and more aware, you can decide that everybody in the world is untrustworthy, which is an untruth. It's not going to make a sensational headline to tell you or me that most of the people in the world are trustworthy and reliable and are going about their lives without drama. That's not going to sell. Keeping us on the edge or allowing ourselves, finding reason to allow ourselves to sit on the edge of anxiety all the time, to be destable, is unfair. But it happens all the time, whether it's in the home where violence breaks out, or in terms of the efforts at domination, or the simple and ongoing effort to exploit. We could easily see, I think, and agree that people could be convinced that's the way the world is. But in a way, it would be like suggesting that there is one set of variables, one set of circumstance on which we can base all our beliefs. And I find that apart from the core principles, my understanding evolves and changes day by day, because I can look at, and we all do, we look at what's happening around us with an expectation in mind, and our observations validate those expectations. The care, particularly for people able to develop a sense of objectivity, is not to pretend that we are rid of those biases or prejudices, but to acknowledge, to search within ourselves and acknowledge that they are there. By doing that, we are able to control them. That statement is a measure of conscience and truth, and the scientific endeavor. Is it a fact? What you're saying is opinion, or something that you and I are seeing. Is so really, when you push it, is there more out there than subjective opinion? Well, yeah, there is, the collective being something more than the components, the component parts, yes. Is there an external reality that we're all trying to discover? And, well, that's a nice question for us to talk about when we're relaxed and looking up at the stars, but not trying to impress one another with our smartness or to define ourselves by all of our achievements. You rarely can even talk about what a better man is, what it means, but we're sure that we're all going to be there at the end. We are a funny little creature in so many ways, but I'm feeling some I don't know if it's pensiveness, that I've been part of this community during the years where if we clip it off in terms of a generation, it's done a considerable amount to pollute, to to rationalize our use of the environment, the world around us, as resources for production. I don't know how we arrived at it. It didn't come out of the blue. It didn't happen and start in the 40s or 50s. This process is that have been begun and were refined decade by decade on. But there you have it. The well has run dry. The rationalizations aren't working anymore. And it's odd to think how it happened. It seems to have crept up. It's not that I'm culpable, I didn't, but I am, you know what I mean? I didn't create polymers, but I've used them and not really questioned. I didn't think about the byproducts being poured into our oceans. It never occurred to me. And when it did, I was stunned because there's, I think, deniability. That somebody else will solve that problem for me, solve that problem for us. And at the same instance, when the solutions are put out there, my goodness, the pushback, whew, on a much, much different and keener, sharper scale. The Brotherhood does that with this business. We become more aware of the big picture and the small picture, the pettiness of interaction and the drama that is completely manufactured by the tedium, my goodness, the tedium of egos. I just find that remarkable. We seem to be so fascinated with it. It's like it doesn't really matter. It doesn't. Time is fleeting. And it's not about talking, saying it, that your time is so very valuable and important. It's treating you with that consideration in mind. Coming to terms with facts. I have some sense of guilt. I don't have the moral indignation or the capacity for deniability. I have this overwhelming sense of responsibility. I am responsible for my life, as you are for yours. In most aspects, the impact of what we have. Well, of course, when we were boys, we didn't have. We didn't have a plastic bag. We often would bring our own container. And we got by somehow. The disposables came later. We would always return those little bottles and get our refund, or it was just convention. It's the way it was. There was a day in our life before the landscape was covered with roads and we were defined by the automobile. It was, we were told, an aspect of freedom to go wherever you wanted. It wasn't all that easy, was it? And now things are going to change. It won't be going back. There's no reverse or reverse gear in life. You know, we always move forward. But in hindsight, hopefully, our great-great-grandparents got by with a different form of transportation. They weren't flying and seemed to live a thoroughly satisfying life. Can we do that? Well, I don't know. If you're ready to have the soother removed, and are we going to ball our fists up and have a little temper tantrum about it? Some will embarrass themselves that way. But not before we have to learn the hard way. Curious, this science that's coming to us and what's happening at our door is inviting us to think about the greater good of the world around us, the herd. I hadn't got through sorting out the tribe, and here comes the herd. Finding some balance seems important, but I don't think that's a modern phenomena. That's being able to satisfy your ambitions and your thoughts, and settle your thoughts so that you can sleep well with your conscience. We no longer have the fire and brimstone punishers of moral incorrectness. We've shifted. The world seems to be looking at religions that generate a sense of order and calm and understanding. And they seem to be doing well. Thank goodness, eh? That hasn't changed. We want better for our children than we had for ourselves. How we define that, bigger car, more wealth, really? That's it? Doesn't really say much about us, does it? Today we're going to jump in to a few ways that men over the centuries have been connecting experience with their conscience and ultimately finding validation. It's important. The challenge, oh my goodness, we face it dramatically. Nobody's going to be able to tell us to enjoy, or that the discovery of the detail is rewarding. Nobody's going to tell us that. We have to find that for ourselves. And we begin often by simply asking ourselves why. But then it's easy to get caught up in the some of the outlandish contradictions if you've ever been minority race, if you've ever experienced what that feels like, you know it's unrelenting. And it puts a chip on the shoulder. It's like, that happens so often. I'll just assume that it's out there everywhere. And it takes an effort to overcome that, to isolate racist comments, divisiveness, to see it as ignorance and what it is, very dangerous. Freemasonry isn't for choir boys. The good man isn't the outgrowth of the little boy who washes his hands and brushes his teeth three times a day. No, it's, this is about the boys that grow into men, making observations that help them to find the patterns and consistencies in the world, to understand the variations in human nature at the earliest onset. One would think we would be using leading indicators the quicker, you know. Think of our stock exchange. They pay for it. They want those systems where the information from the mind face, from the geologists traipsing around the hills, gets to them before anybody else, so that they can make decisions before anybody else, before governments, before banks. What's it say about us? Do we use those leading indicators or the following indicators? The ones that lag, you know, we should have seen that coming. Well, we've in a way, we've waited until the building has been on fire or the stable's been empty before we think, oh my goodness, I should do something about that. Or more pertinently, I thought somebody else was going to take care of that for us. Thank goodness for maturity, eh? Realizing that at the end of the day, if you want something done, it's not that pouty, I have to do it myself. It's a fact. You want something to happen? Invest yourself in it. And if you're expecting life to be easy, gee, you have been wasting your time. So, when you sit back and listen today, we have some music that we have the music that will just, I think, it's transformative, yeah, I think. The connections with all that mathematics, all the notes and the spacings, how it stimulates, tell me, I'm still fascinated. I know how it does, but it's fascinating that it could, these sounds can reach in and stimulate emotion. I keep urging people to experiment in their own way to notice the effect of different types of music on them. Explore them well. It gives us if you need an excuse, it gives you an excuse or a reason to be sampling all types of music. I was very happy in with my own shortcomings until the world through the internet opened up, and I found I'm just devoted to music analysis. I just love hearing the musicologists teach me about the music, how it was formed, and the statements, and particularly the allegory. I just find that fascinating. So, you know, what was Mahler trying to shape? What was he, in a way, trying to say? And when you hear it, was he successful? Or Wagner, then I just think Wagner was just a great big hero worshiping boy, fairies and fantasy, heroic legend. The delicacy, and then the delicacy. It wasn't, you know, when I actually hear the breakdown, it's like an acceleration in learning. That's you bear witness to the efforts of somebody else to probe a particular subject. You don't have to be a physicist to listen to somebody talking about your friend Mitch talking about sacred circles and sacred geometry and crop circles, but it's fascinating to listen to him help us to connect all that math. Makes me wonder if there is a philosophy of mathematics that we live, but we don't always understand. Enough. I hope you enjoy the program today, of course. And I hope you find those conversations breaking out around you or participating. Don't feel you need to be a presence or be an influence until you've had the satisfaction of bearing witness on the conversation. The task, one of the tasks about organization and groups and influence is to learn to be the last one to speak. Here. With that, I'll be the first one to stop. This is a little ditty. You'll like it, I think. Thank you. It's a different way of thinking when you listen to music like that, isn't it? It's Chet Baker. He left this earth, I think, 7 years ago now. But he left us something remarkable. Remarkable. We, I think, it can be generally said that we people need to be validated in some way, be recognized. Is it, and then we get into the whole matter of being recognized for what and how. The nastiness, masonry is nasty. Talks to us, to the mind, about arrogance and humility. About innocence and wisdom. Who talks like that? We pick up a volume of King James knowing it was contrived, it was manufactured. But it contains some very interesting threads. We're not likely to throw it out. Even theology schools have found that constant need for accuracy. They don't use that old the old version. It's not like dragging your Studebaker out of the garage for a Sunday drive, looking in the rearview mirror and seeing clouds of blue smoke. No, it's not like that. It's the freshness of the ideas. Are they still fresh? It's the questions that masonry asks that remain fresh. There's not one time when one answer was enough for all of us. We each have that opportunity to get to the head of the line, and it's not like the oracle where we come up with our profound question and then she tells us an answer, leaving us to sort out what in the hell she's talking about. No, Freemasonry puts those challenges, the Herculean challenges, in front of us. Oh, the clamor, my goodness. The clamor to provide us with answers is sad. The assumption that people are too stupid to understand what the question, why they're being questioned, and to come up with a thoughtful answer. It's all about cynicism, man. Nobody provides you an answer to these questions. Nobody, they can try it, you know, but it never quite works. Here's a thought on it. To find men who have the capability to benefit from Freemasonry requires a generalizable understanding of particular traits. Like merit, this is so valued that it is the essential qualifier that catches our attention, as it should. It would take time. Impatience has too often pushed that task aside. The idea here is to examine whether a man shows indication of merit before we talk with them. We find traces of this where we replace merit with celebrity or some aspect that argues the importance of an individual. Both such conditions are no substitute for a simple proof that a man within his own life has made a significant contribution of some dimension. If he is able to commit or and has a sense of spirituality, our ritual articulates certain tasks against which his progress is measured, completely in his own hands. In order to do this, a lodge needs to be significantly aware. Otherwise, selection is a random process, making it very difficult to shape the lodge character. I'd be suspicious of a group that doesn't have shared core beliefs. No two lodges are ever the same, though. Affinity lodges have experienced a renaissance in some areas. Now, people with similarity background. Where I come from, the island, is we often find that accountants, police, fire, people who work in a particular field form Masonic lodges. Doesn't it make sense? It cuts down on the chafing, my goodness. Against a strong cultural backstop, other lodges go about their work with presence of mind, where the business at hand is reverence for one another, heightening the importance of ritual and mutually rewarding association. Some men become very self-conscious when exposed to reason thinking. Others find the very thought an exciting opportunity. If a man chose to be limited by his experience, how could he possibly be receptive to the expansiveness of ideas? It is not to suggest every seat is taken by somebody who appreciates the arts, but it does suggest that appreciation is much more rewarding than feeling compelled to listen. FM is no accident. It is a rich tapestry offered in symbolic language spoken by intelligent minds. No panacea except for being sanctuary. We ask the question. It's like, not for the apathetic or it stretches us out there. If we have a shred of cynicism about us, and it's startling. It's like years ago, back in the 70s, talking with my close friend, Lindsay, thinking that in my narrow experience, racism didn't exist. Well, Lindsay was a black fellow from London School of Economics type of guy. You know the type. Lovely man. Very cultured. And he immediately, and we didn't discuss it at length very much, he immediately said, yes, of course. Every day he had experienced it. He didn't walk around with that chippiness. But every day. And that was a startling, in a way, that hit home. And when I hear other friends saying, I didn't do it, therefore I don't have any responsibility. So much for the herd mentality. Eh? Coming to grips and moving on. And understanding. Always the understanding. That's, in that is the advantage, the leading indicators. What does it tell you? We don't shape reality. We can shape the experience. Yeah. Why can some people moan and complain about digging a post hole and others attack it with vigor, with purpose? Without the tedium, why is that? Masonry is like that, but it threw away the instruction manual that told us how to think. Just gave us the damn question. Yeah. You'll understand more of what I'm getting at when you listen to this. This is Coleman Hawkins and Ben Webster. Yeah. That's what I meant. Understand now what I was getting at, I'm sure. I should trust the music more often. It should stop talking. The craft is different when we're relaxed and enjoying ourselves. You be careful. Select men that have a sense of humor so that we can put calamity in perspective. Don't have a sense of humor, that, you know, your mind does very, very strange things. And stop exaggerating all the time. And that's just tedious. The world has enough. The world has enough drama naturally without us trying to manufacture it every single day. It doesn't sharpen the pencil or the mind to live on the constant state of drama. It's after a while, it's just background noise. You know? How do we find ourselves coming together, gentlemen? How is this possible? This tiny group of people that actually are willing to try to be tested in a way. You know, when we start to commit to Freemasonry through oaths, we realize that we're facing a process where we're taught ideals, and we can't. Human beings don't live ideals, of course, but we need to break them down into something that we can manage and understand. The ideal may be the aspiration or that brass ring. That's fine, but we never quite grasp it. It's always something that we aspire to achieve. That's important in life. The craft allows us to actually consider a deeper understanding. And the way we do that isn't just tossing somebody into the deep end and say, here, go find it. We share examples. And some of it is lyrical, like we have here today. Truths. Where do you find it? Is it the mathematicians? Is Turing? Did Turing give us truths? Well, we persecuted him pretty seriously. That's how brilliant we are. Was Darwin? Did Darwin give us truths? Well, we persecuted him too. Was there any genius that we didn't persecute? Well, no. Copernicus? Well, threw him in prison. Here. This is a poet. Maybe the bravest of the brave, telling us about sharing and telling us about aspects of thinking and life that reveal something about ourselves and this funny little contraption we call a soul and this tedious business that we think of as conscience. And intelligence, oh, well, we're so certain that we aren't, so we need to be dismissive. A preoccupation is projection, isn't it? This is a fascinating, fascinating a poet, Rainier Maria Rilke. He was born in 1875, just to give you a quick perspective. And he lived till well on into 1926. He became, it said, one of the finest European poets of the 20th century. And he wrote in French and German. Woo, yeah. But boy was from Austria, and he traveled through Europe. And after a while, I get tired of hearing that. I want to do that. I want to share that. But he spent time in Germany and France and Spain and Italy and Russia. Yeah, his time in Russia was compelling, remarkable people he rubbed shoulders with. That's what happens when you get known for not being afraid of human expression. And he was a poet, of course. So I won't bore you with the being born, the disappointment of his father and the boy growing up, blaming his mother for all the ills in his life. You know, not too unusual. But he fell in love, at 22, he fell in love with a woman who was a writer, a poet, Lou Andreas Salome. She was 12 years senior. And then she went on and became a psychoanalyst under Freud. A couple of years later, he married a sculptor. And they became parents in 1901, and then they separated. And then this guy, Relke, became secretary of Rodin, the sculptor in Paris. And it was Rodin that gave him the idea of looking at objects. When you need inspiration to look at an object, and the inspiration will come from the object. And so he gained this reputation of being one of the finest lyrical writers about object poetry. Here, short poem, beautiful. He's communicating simple, profound metaphor. Oh, of course, metaphor, you know, we're Freemasons. And he tells us of the goal of the sunny hill. Here, it's the walk. What am I saying? The walk. Already, my gaze is upon the hill, the sunny one, at the end of the path which I've only just begun. So we are grasped by that which we could not grasp at such great distance, so fully manifest. You know, you're looking off and you're seeing it. And it changes us, even when we do not reach it, into something that hardly sensing it, we already are. A sign appears echoing our own sign. But what we sense is the wind against us. He tells us about the goal. You know, looking at this sunny hill. You've been there. You look up and you see it. And the start of the walk and you think, right, let's set to it. Only there's an energy to your step. And as the muscles weary and the lactic acid builds up, you take a pause and then you look back up the hill again. And you think about the view. But we cannot grasp onto its impact upon us, even though the hill is far away. The end of the path changes, even if we do not reach the goal. The end of the path changes, even if we do not reach the goal. We sense the walker and the goal are already together, and the goal and ourselves echo each other. The sign is blowing in the wind. The wind coming off the hill blows upon us with this realization. You've been there. The top of the hill is sunny, but you know the wind accelerates at the top of the hills. It often on those slopes, brrr, bit out in that. Was he successful? I don't know. What's the success that you find when you listen to a piece of poetry? Already my gaze is upon the hill, the sunny one. Well, you can even wake up with that notion. Here's what I have duties today to myself, and enjoying them is part of it. Can I sculpt a mindset that enables me to find satisfaction and joy in everything that I do? Oh, we'll see about that. Thank you. And I have to just throw in a little Canadian content. Oscar Peterson. Lovely. Lovely. I kind of find a kindred sensibility when a well-known writer or an author talks about the tedium of stupidity. I don't know what that says about me. I don't have the patience for it that I used to, but I'm far less dramatic and obvious about it. Because I find that that is, if it is leaving stupidity to trigger me, trigger emotion, and waste my time. Because I can't really do anything about it. It's like, why can't stupidity be changed? Now, I don't fault human beings for being born with the abilities that they have on that range, whether it's the 87% intellectual IQ that the American Army found was the tipping point. Anything below that couldn't be taught. Anything above was, you know, they needed to do that and invested quite a bit of time to sort and ensure that their officer corps was included the people with the most ability. Stupidity. Here, we're going to refer here to some of the big guns in history. If such a thing exists. This is a Newton. We're talking about Newton in a historical perspective. Context. Not that it's a judgment. You keep your value judgments to yourself, you know. Really. You have value judgments, who cares? Actually, you. And how is it working for you? Most often, it doesn't. The early Newtonians, it is said, laid great emphasis upon order, stability, and the rule of law. The belief in the order proclaimed by science in turn encouraged Masonic fantasies about the possibility of creating perfect harmony in human society, if only within the confines of the lodge. Yet the Newtonian model also explicitly proclaimed a rigid spiritual hierarchy within nature and by implication within society. We see this in our ritual, you know, some men are born, remember that little phrase? And by implication within society, spiritual forces, active principles, rules over brute stupid matter. Active principles rules over brute and stupid matter. Ah, okay. Not surprisingly, Masonic aspirations for stability and perfectibility were not always compatible. Masonic idealism carried within its boundaries an inherent tension. Harmony required perfectibility. Even if this could be achieved within the lodge, could it ever, indeed should it ever, be sealed off from the larger society? Little wonder that in the 1760s, when agitation for reform led by Wilkes threatened to destabilize society and government, the Masonic orators acutely reflected both the agitation of the country and the stability symbolized by the court. For most of the century, however, Masonic orators dwelt upon their utopian vision. They savored certain especially pleasing and salutary aspects of their benevolent, progressive, and, as they imagined it, ancient creed. One of the most commonplace expressions of that sentiment appeared in the Standard Almanac used year in and year out by the practicing Freemason. The Freemason's Pocket Companion first appeared in 1735, and it was followed by a multitude of editions and translations. Oh, I have one sitting over on my shelf. Each copy contained a reprint of the 1723 Constitution's lists and addresses of known lodges in London and the environs, Masonic feast dates, songs, and a short, largely mythical history of the progress bestowed upon humanity by the fraternity. Mythical history, yeah. We created the legends, huh? The companion informed its possessor that the growth of Freemasonry augurs the pleasing prospect of having, even in our own days, the arts of the famed Augustan age revive amongst us. Credo, the easy equation is made between the building of public and especially domestic mansions and the revival of learning. Indeed, the ancient Romans had enjoyed such a revival, but it was destroyed by the Goths, who, with very little knowledge of geometry, gave us the ugliness of the Gothic. The Renaissance in Italy, more especially the great Palladio, revived the Augustan style of architecture, and Inigo Jones, the great court architect of the early 17th century, brought it to England. Masonic architects are portrayed at every turn as the harbingers of cultural revival, which is symbolized totally by the splendid Palladian mansions of the new oligarchy. The Earl of Burlington is mentioned by name. The Freemasons gloried in the transformation of the royal style of the 17th century into the court, and hence oligarchic style of the 18th. We may find the interiors of these surviving mansions garish. This is not the judgment of contemporaries who identified with the cultural values they proclaimed. In urging him to identify with the opulence of the court style, the Pocket Companion told the Freemason that places like Houghton Hall in Norfolk, built by the great Whig oligarch and prime minister Sir Robert Walpole, was in itself a sure sign of cultural vitality. The Palladian style, as it appeared in the new mansions of the oligarchs, thrilled the Masonic imagination. It was pagan and ancient, ornate yet symmetrical. Most of all, these huge edifices and landscape gardens surrounded by vast landed estates symbolize the private and domestic realm of patronage, prosperity, and power. Out of these private enclaves came the foundations of an order and a stability, imitating the cosmic order decreed by Providence and confirmed by scientific observation. A Masonic poet of 1739, with more enthusiasm than literary talent, rejoiced by order and simplicity alone. we'll pick that up the next time. That's what was said. Alliance. Same thing. And the more things change, the more things remain the same. Così fa tutte. We are, in a way, this collective, 7.8 billion of us now. I wonder, these authors, these early Masonic authors, aren't discrediting the beauty of minimalism. If you've experienced that in Japanese architecture and gardens, or the Danish, it's not accounting for it. The Goths, the Gothic style of architecture, and then the need to, the suggestion that compliance was gave the advantage of stability. What messages go through our order today at the speed of the transmission of information across the world? What messages are coming with us? Well, we have the comfort of sorting that out deliberately. All of those questions that are put to us, all of those challenges, and then we have our own, this question of purpose. All of that seems to be settled in a way, only in a way, through our embrace of philosophy. We walked through the forest now with poetry echoing in our ears, or we sit by the ocean and look at that cascade, and we become part of it. It's not that we're alien anymore. The philosophy connects us. We reason through the beauty of it. My goodness, we're actually listening to the, paying attention to the ideas of Newton and to Darwin and Kant and Spinoza and Aristotle. Oh, how about that? We still have the ability to recognize the intelligent statements that have value and resonate. Reasoning, that's we're in the era of refinement. The you think the logic of what was taught to us in this period of history, you know, the end of the 18th century, cresting into the 19th, is teaching us about the future. We are going to constantly be in a process of refinement and understanding. And our understanding today is not that of 18th century or 17th century or 16th. We have that as hindsight. And so it's important that we have our history, that what we grasp is accurate, as accurate as we can possibly find it. And so we change based on the newness. We're willing to exchange what we formerly, the best that we could formerly achieve with the best that we currently achieve, new knowledge. Keeps telling us new things about old ideas and about us. Thanks for sitting in today. Thanks for being part of this, so this ongoing soiree. I hope you found some kernels that are interesting. I'd like to acknowledge and I'm very grateful to the support of my homeland, of course, but you're an impressive lot out there and a bit daunting when I think about it. Listeners from Ireland and Netherlands and Denmark and Germany and Greece and Croatia and India and Australia and Britain. It makes me sit up and pay careful attention and deeply appreciate this exchange. It's something that I enjoy too, sitting back and listening and carrying on with you. Thanks for your time. I hope it was well worth your investment, and I look forward to having you sit in with us next week. Thanks.